The nuclear arsenal managed by Malmstrom Air Force Base could be in for some changes. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about a Missoula company that just got a big financial boost. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a Chinese exile scholar and author about the legacy of the Tiananmen protest and massacre. A plan to remove 50 missiles from America's land-based nuclear arsenal should not significantly affect operations at Montana's Malmstrom Air Force Base. That's according to Senator John Tester, who says he is happy with how the U.S. Defense Department is complying with a nuclear reduction treaty signed with Russia in 2011. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says it's not clear how many missiles will be pulled from Malmstrom.
The U.S. and Russia limited themselves to 700 deployed nuclear weapons apiece through the 2011 New START, or Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. Russia is already well below that limit, 473 at last check, but the U.S. was sitting at 809. In ratcheting down to 700, the U.S. is pulling missiles from all three legs of what's called the nuclear triad. Some from bomber airplanes, some from nuclear submarines, and the rest from the arsenal of land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs. Those ICBMs are operated by bases in Wyoming, North Dakota, and Malmstrom Air Force Base manages the 150 missiles scattered around Montana. Senator John Tester says he's happy to see only 50 missiles removed from the total of 450. And he says reducing those missiles will not reduce personnel.
I think where the win is here is that, you know, the missile silos, even though they may not have a missile in them, will be kept operational.
This would allow the military to move the remaining warheads between silos.
To make sure the folks who want to do us harm don't know where they're at.
The deadline for removing these missiles is not until 2018. Tester says it's unclear how many will be taken from Malmstrom, and that may always be the case.
Because of the nature of the security of this, that information may be classified forever because we do not want the people who want to do us harm to know which silos are open and which silos have missiles in them.
Tester does not think recent drug use and an exam cheating scandal among launch officers at Malmstrom will impact how many missiles are removed from the base.
I think this is nothing more than a black eye, a wound that will be healed.
The 50 missiles removed from the fleet will not be destroyed. Rather, they will be put into standby status, stored at their base, or in some cases sent in for repairs or maintenance. Hans Christensen is an arms control expert at the Federation of American Scientists. He calls the overall plan to conform to the START Treaty disappointing. He said in an email exchange with the Associated Press, the decision appears to have more to do with the Obama administration surrendering to what he calls the ICBM caucus in Congress than with strategic considerations about national security. Senator Tester calls the ICBMs the most cost-effective nuclear deterrent the U.S. has. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, officials with the Valley Veterans Service Center in Hamilton say a former employee who was charged last week with making threats against President Barack Obama may have taken veterans' records home with him. Program coordinator Matt Goetz tells KECI-TV that the center is working with the Department of Veterans Affairs General Counsel in Washington, D.C. to retrieve those files. Goetz says former claims agent Dan Rochelle of Darby had power of attorney and is believed to have taken 300 to 400 claims for disability compensation, pension, or health care benefits home with him on the first day of an internal investigation into the way Rochelle was treating clients. Goetz says the center is working with VA attorneys to revoke Rochelle's power of attorney and have the files returned. No charges have been filed related to the files.
A Missoula-based company that produces plant sugar-based chemicals announced today it's received a $26 million shot in the arm. Rivertop Renewables CEO Mike Knopf says the financing will allow the company to not only double its workforce, but help prepare for the production of commercial quantities of its products. Rivertop manufactures what Knopf calls novel chemicals, or sugar acids to be more precise.
Well, our first markets are in detergents. We have a product that we've been developing that we call Rios Detergent Builder. It'll be used in automatic dishwash detergents. We also have a corrosion inhibitor which we call Headwaters Corrosion Inhibitor, that's used in salt brines that are sprayed on the roads as de-icing solutions during the winter. So we've been marketing that product for 3 years now, and our best customer is the Montana Department of Transportation.
Knopf says Rivertop has, up until now, been mainly funded by local investors and friends and family.
For this round of financing, we went out to the venture world and found First Green Partners, and then we found a strategic investor in the large agribusiness company Cargill. So the two of them, First Green Partners and Cargill, along with a number of other investors, have invested a total of about $26 million in the company.
Knopf says the infusion of money will have profound impacts on the company.
We currently have about 20 employees based here in Missoula, and we'll be doubling in size roughly over the next 6 to 8 months. And because we're going to be supporting our commercialization efforts, and the first part of that effort is to begin producing at scale. We'll be doing that with a contract manufacturer in Virginia, and there'll be more announcements in the future about that. But we're also piloting a new second-generation process here in Missoula that will be operating this pilot or semi-works facility.
Knopf says Rivertop will research new ways to convert their new investors' feedstock into products of value.
State lawmakers are considering changing the way the person who polices their conduct in election campaigns is chosen. A committee voted today to draft legislation that would create a panel to choose Commissioner of Political Practice nominees for the governor to appoint. Currently, the governor does not have to pick any of the candidates recommended by legislative leaders, but his appointment must be confirmed by the state Senate. The Senate hasn't confirmed an appointee since 2010, leading to a revolving door of short-term commissioners and accusations the appointments are driven by partisan politics. State Administration and Veterans Affairs Interim Committee Chairwoman Dee Brown says the panel is looking to improve the commissioner's credibility and effectiveness. Other suggestions include replacing the commissioner with a full commission and watering down his powers.
With the goal in mind of further reducing carbon emissions from the University of Montana, students today presented a $5,600 check to partially fund carbon offsets. UM adopted a climate action plan in 2010 that outlined strategies to reduce its carbon emissions. The first goal of that plan was to reduce emissions 10% below 2007 levels by next year. UM junior Kara Kolovich is majoring in environmental studies and minoring in climate change studies. Kolovich says that while there's been plenty of progress in reducing campus emissions, it's not happening fast enough. She says a grant from the Student Sustainability Fee Fund was used to purchase carbon offsets, which is meant to help expedite the process.
You can buy carbon offsets on the market. And so you purchase it from a organization, and that money goes to fund sequestration methods for sequestering greenhouse gases, or say to prevent future emissions from happening, such as investments in renewable energy that are low carbon technologies.
UM Environmental Studies Associate Professor Robin Saha says purchase credits like these can have real world impacts.
For example, Hull's Dairy down the road in the Bitterroot is working on a cow manure digester that captures the methane, can be used then for other energy projects and offset those emissions from the university. They're seeking to get certification right now so that they can be tied into an offset purchasing agreement.
Saha says purchased carbon offsets are not a cure-all solution to addressing climate change, but just one element of an entire suite of options, and particularly helpful for emissions that are particularly difficult to address, such as travel-related emissions. Kolovich says the purchase credits will offset approximately 1,130 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent from the atmosphere.
Rowena Hu was a teenager in China when the Tiananmen democracy protests began. The June 4, 1989 massacre, when the Chinese government moved in to murder many of the protesters, marked a turning point for her and many others of her generation. who eventually moved to Canada and the U.S. and now teaches at Harvard University. She's also the author of a new book called Tiananmen Exiles, which tells her story and that of three other Chinese exiles. Hu is in Missoula to deliver tonight's president's lecture at the University of Montana. In this feature interview, Hu talks with news director Sally Mock about the Tiananmen movement, which she points out was not limited to Beijing, but was nationwide.
So I was in the Guangzhou city, in Guangzhou, right next to Hong Kong. And like many of the ordinary students at that time, I was not a student leader of any kind, but I also participated in the movement. And I was at the age, I was 17 years old at that time.
And what did you recall about what happened that day when the government and the military moved in?
Mm-hmm. I have to say, like, I was just a kid, like, in today's standard. Before 1989, I was not in any sense politically active or anyway, but we grow up, like, I was born during Mao's Cultural Revolution and grow up in China's open reform era. So we have this kind of idealistic sentiments about what we can contribute to the country. So I think there's one thing that's make the movement stand out is it's not like later on what we saw in Arab Spring. It's not out of anger, out of frustration, out of grievances, but it's more out of love, out of passion, and out of idealism. So that's what the Tiananmen generation was about. So to get back to my experience, I think at that time, we were just thinking that we were following the Chinese tradition of helping the rulers to improve. Like, nobody was thinking that we were going to overthrow the government in any way. So that was why when the actual massacre happened on June 4th. Although I was not in Beijing, but since I was so near Hong Kong, I was able to watch all the news and things like that. And it was really totally shocked, right? Of course,
in like, a sense of betrayal by the government?
It was definitely the betrayal of loyalty. That's what I said in my book, the theme, because we did what we were taught. We should sacrifice for our country and the nation and the people and to help the country to be a better place, right?
And had no idea that you were risking your lives.
Yeah, so we eventually we were punished because we did what we were taught. That's what I call the betrayal of loyalty. I think it's also a trauma, an open wound for many people who live through it because justice is still not done and people are still not allowed to openly talk about it. The Tiananmen mothers cannot still not even be able to mourn their children openly, right? Exiles are still banned from returning to China and scholars, major scholars who study Tiananmen would be regularly banned from getting a visa to China.
I read that soon after the massacre that you wore a black armband to school and
yes.
You were asked to take it off.
Yes, exactly. So I think that was almost like a turning a moment that really changed my life, right? So I went back to my school and wearing a black armband, and my teacher basically came over and said, if you do not take that off, nobody can protect you from now on.
And so you did.
I did. I cowardly did. And at first I thought, I still argue with people and I said that, you know, this is massacre. But very soon we know the arrest was happening, punishment was happening. And instead of telling people what happened or talking about it, I just, you know, recite all the what the government told us to say in exams in order to pass exams, like this is a counter-revolutionary riot and our army has successfully cracked down this counter-revolutionary riot. So I openly always said that at the age of 17, I learned to lie in order to survive.
You have a story about your father's reaction when Mao Zedong died in 1976 and the reaction to Tiananmen. You draw a parallel there and tell that story.
Yeah, so when Mao died, I was a little kid, right? So during Mao's Cultural Revolution, during the Cultural Revolution, and my father, you know, I just saw him inviting his best friend to our tiny little room, and he closed all the doors and windows. He brought out the only wine we had at home at that time. And they started to drink wine, and they seemed really so happy.
Celebrating his death.
Yeah, really. It feels they're very happy. And the next day, they took me to this public memorial service, and everyone was crying, and they looked very sad too. So I was really confused by the adults' contrasting facial expressions at that time. Like, why they were so happy the night before, right? All of a sudden, the next day, they felt so sad. But that's exactly the contrast happened in 1989, right? So we were so sad. His friends were drinking at our home again after the massacre. But outside, we could not show our sadness. So,
and you also write that even after you moved to Canada and to the U.S. and were doing research on Tiananmen, mm-hmm. you kept that quiet. You were afraid to make that public.
I think the fear has never stopped, even up to this moment, right? So, and that's exactly...
You still have family in China that
everyone,
you're worried about.
Yeah, I feel for people who are idealistic, sometimes I would feel that we are selfish too, because we choose to be idealistic, but your family members cannot choose whether they want to be your family or not. And they are the ones to have to, if you're, I myself or anyone who's the idealistic, if I am willing to pay the price, they don't have a choice because they are my family, right? So I am constantly under this kind of fear whether I would be able to go home again, and what I should say, how much publicity I should do for my book, whether I should want it to be translated.
And yet here the book is. I mean, you
yes.
are being courageous to have even written the book.
I always see myself a coward in that sense. I feel I do this not because I'm courageous, I'm brave. I think I do this because I still remember the fear we have to go through. And when I saw my Chinese students now coming to Harvard, and they told me either they do not want to take my course because they are scared, or they want to make sure that if they take my course, I would not make, you know, tell anyone they're taking my course. So I feel like at the best university in the world, intellectual freedom is at core of our education. And my people, like students from China, they cannot still feel that they can speak out. And that's the reason that I think it's so important that for a coward like me still want to speak out. I think it's just human nature.
You've written about the current generation in China this, quote, later generations, under the effects of the patriotic campaign by the government, tend not to distinguish between the regime and the nation, and they defend the Beijing government as if they are defending China itself.
I was really confused and puzzled all those years when I was studying Tiananmen, why the younger generation was so angry at me, why people would accuse me about lying, and where those anger and those nationalist sentiments come from. So that's how I started to inquire what happened to the younger generation after us. And I studied all the revised textbooks in political education and history education, and how this whole nationalistic sentiments about defending China means that you need to defend anyone who is critical of the country's government, the regime.
And yet, Dr. Hu, you have optimism about the possibility of change in China, because you've also written that, quote, on June 4th, the seeds of democracy were planted in my heart and the longing for freedom and human rights nourished. So it was not an ending, after all, but another beginning.
Mm-hmm. I think let's put it this way. I think Tiananmen may always remind us of repression, but it also symbolizes people's power, and it also symbolizes human beings' struggle for human rights and democracy. And as long as the desire for freedom is always humane, and the longing for basic rights is universal, I'm sure the world will witness the spirit of Tiananmen as the power of the powerless again and again. So in any country, anywhere, I believe that history is on our side.
We have been speaking with Dr. Rowena Hu, who is keeping the memory of Tiananmen alive with her new book. It's called Tiananmen Exiles. And Dr. Hu, it's been a privilege to have you in our studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be in Montana.
Rowena Hu will give a free public lecture on China since Tiananmen tonight at 8 o'clock in the Denison Theater on the University of Montana campus.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies with highs in the mid-50s to lower 60s. In central Montana tonight, it calls for partly cloudy skies with lows in the 30s. Wind gusts could be up to 35 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with highs 55 to 60 degrees with west wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. And in southwest Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with isolated rain and snow showers, lows 30 to 35 degrees and wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs 50 to 60 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Patricia Rosenleaf.
A while back, Charles Osgood, the host of Sunday Morning, a television news magazine presented on, of all time, Sunday Morning, made some remarks about the United States Postal Service, which I found uncalled for. I wrote him a letter, and it reads, "Well, Charlie, you old curmudgeon, I can't tell you how surprised and disappointed I was at your editorializing comments about the U.S. Postal Service. First of all, I don't think it's becoming of a host to utter deprecating remarks about anyone or anything. Your job, as I have observed it, is to present others analyzing and maybe even commenting on what is happening around the country and the world. You personally are there to present segues between the different articles and to give us a brief look-see at the articles and the major headlines of the day. You also end each 90-minute edition with a cheery "see you on the radio" send-off. I've been a faithful follower of Sunday Morning for a number of years, and that's all I've ever seen you do aside from play the piano at Christmas time. Editorializing just doesn't seem to be in your job description. Second, I believe your comments were not only rude, but also totally off base. Have you or any of the other million detractors of the Postal Service ever considered what the USPS does and does well and with more regularity than any service I can think of? For a pittance of less than 50 cents, it delivers to your door, privately and with astounding speed, missives and packages from down the street or around the world. Believe me, I've seen other systems, such as the Czech Republic's. When my daughter was living in that lovely country, I mailed a care package to her. After weeks, the package still hadn't been delivered, so my daughter trekked down to the local post office to inquire about the missing bundle. The official's first question was, "What year was it mailed?" I learned quickly that not all countries are equal in postal services. Before I get to point three, may I assure you that I am not connected in any way with anyone who works at the post office or who has ever worked there. My only contact is with my own personal mailman who, whenever he sees me outside, inquires after my day and asks about the family. How many lonely people in this country do you think might look forward to such contact? I say personal because not only does my carrier deliver with speed and accuracy, he's been my postman for years. He is a familiar face in a sea of strangers who come to the door. I also know that were I ever in trouble, he would help. I believe our postmen and women are enjoined to be aware of suspicious happenings on their routes. So not only are we getting our mail, we're also assigned someone who cares about the neighborhood and is alert to things going on in his or her route. In a third point, is 50 cents really such a burden when you consider that the average person doesn't even quail at $5 cups of coffee or $10 hamburgers or $50 haircuts? As you can imagine, I like to write. I love to send thank you and get well cards, birthday greetings, and care for you notes. Email is quicker, but the idea of receiving the handwritten note just speaks to me of a care beyond an email, text, or tweet. Someone who has personal interest enough about another to sit down, pen a letter or greeting, stick said note into an envelope, put a stamp on it, address it, and see that it gets mailed is a person whose gestures go beyond the average correspondence of today. In this time of speed trumping almost everything, such an activity means more than it ever did. To know then, at the end of this process, that my letter to a friend or acquaintance will be delivered with efficiency and care to that person, to me is worth the time and effort. 50 cents is too much, really? Don't think for a minute that I'm naive enough to believe that my paltry 50 cents a letter will support the mail system. I know that millions of our tax dollars go to the USPS. I also know that millions in aid go to Afghanistan, where the United States is just another in a long line of countries who's getting its butt handed to it on a shovel. We send billions in aid to other countries, whether they would like to see us wiped off the planet or not. Just this week, it was announced that we are preparing to send $2 billion to the government of the Ukraine. Now, I won't question our government on such aid if, in turn, my government allows us to keep our mail service. As the USPS proudly proclaims, neither sleet nor storm nor dark of night will keep us from our appointed rounds, and I, for one, applaud them and appreciate their diligence and constancy. The Postal Service is a service. We don't expect police and fire departments to turn a profit. Why is that expectation put on the United States Postal Service? With any luck at all, we will continue to receive our mail on Saturdays and rural post offices will stay open. I don't believe, Charlie, that your ill-placed comments will keep our post people from doing their jobs. However, your reputation and the good feelings that most people have about you and your program are powerful and possess the propensity to undermine. Negativity and polarity abound in this country. How about adding some of that trademark sunshine positivity? Charlie, I want you to go to your bedroom and sit and think about what you said. This is Patricia Rosenleaf, a citizen of the United States who appreciates a fine service when she encounters it.
Patricia Rosenleaf is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.